Thank you very much. I'm always amazed every time I come here, the building doubles in size. So what I'm going to talk about today is an incredibly elementary topic, a topic that perhaps if Abel had lived a little bit longer, maybe he would have, maybe this would be classical mathematics. You know, maybe this would just be the thing he did in the week after, you know, the week later after he died. And then he probably would have gone on to revolutionize mathematics even more than he did. So that's already 200 years ago. It's really about differential equations. My talk is about differential equations, ordinary differential equations. Okay, so so an ordinary differential equation. I don't know if this is really not visible, but. Yeah, so an ordinary differential equation, let me take a very simple type of equation, a linear one. And so here, alpha and beta are smooth functions. And so this is a second order linear ODE. As we know, as we all learned in ODE class, you can just set V to be U prime. And then you could transform this second order system to a first order system. And you can always do this for these ODEs, for these linear ODEs. You can always transform them into a first-order system, but of higher rank. And this first-order system of higher rank has an interpretation in geometry as a connection, meaning that if you have a vector-valued function, you can differentiate it, and you can multiply it by a matrix which may depend on the point Z that you're sitting at. And such operators, such differential operators, which involve differentiation and a linear term, those are called connections. So here, this is the Durham derivative of each component, and here there's just the one form so that the units, if you wish, line up, that we get differentials and differentials here when we multiply. So this means that the theory of linear ODEs is subsumed into the topic of connections, flat connections, right? And so what we're really studying is connections, and we're looking for flat sections of our vector bundle. So the study of linear ODEs is really the study of flat connections on vector bundles of higher rank over the complex plane or over a Riemann surface or really over any manifold. That's what the theory of these linear differential equations really is. So, you know, now that we've seen that a differential equation is really a connection, you can also think of it in a way as a representation. So whenever you have a connection, you can always, given a vector field, you can always kind of plug in the vector field. And so now you're differentiating your vector-valued functions, you're differentiating your sections in a specific direction. So you're getting the directional derivatives and so you get an operation on sections of the vector bundle, like this, a differential operator. And we know that if the curvature vanishes, then what that means is that if I take a Lie bracket of vector fields and act by differentiation, it's the same thing as taking the commutator of the two actions of the two vector fields, right? As we know, so this is the flatness of the connection. And the flatness of the connection is telling us that we have a representation of the Lie algebra of vector fields. So what we're going to do is we're going to think of a connection on a vector bundle as being a representation of the vector fields. Flat connections are representations of the vector fields. And to be more precise, there's a terminology is that this vector bundle with flat connection is a representation of the tangent bundle, which is viewed as what is called a Lie algebroid. So a Lie algebroid is basically like a Lie algebra. Here we're thinking of the Lie algebra of vector fields, V, except that we want to remember the fact that this Lie algebra came to us as sections of a vector bundle. And such vector bundles are Lie algebroids. They carry Lie algebra structures on their sections. Okay, so now we can see that a flat connection can be viewed as a representation of something. Okay, so now you should think that, think of the analogy with Lie group theory. You know, when you study representations of Lie groups, actually what you normally do is you study representations of Lie algebras. You take a finite dimensional Lie algebra, study its root system, figure out its representations, and then you use some relationship between that Lie algebra and the Lie group to determine representations of groups. So here, what we really have is a representation of a Lie algebra. Okay. So when you want to go from the Lie algebra to the Lie group, this involves solving a differential equation, not just writing one down. Writing one down is writing down the connection. But now we want to solve it. We want to use this famous theorem that, you know, given an initial condition, you have existence and uniqueness for solutions to ODEs. Okay, so here I drew a picture. Let's say we have a base point z0 and a path gamma. Then you can solve the equation from z0 to z as long as I give you an initial condition. And so what this means is that there's a map from initial conditions to final conditions, right? So there's a vector space of initial conditions where you give, you know, the value of the function, the value of its first derivative, second derivative, up to whatever order your system is, right? So you give this vector of initial data, and then you parallel transport it. You solve the equation, and you get a vector over here. That's a linear map which usually is denoted by a matrix solution, psi. So this is the typical notation, psi of z. They usually just write it as psi of z, which is a fundamental solution, meaning that it's an n by n matrix whose columns give a basis for the solutions to the ODE. And usually they write it only as a function of z, even though really this matrix is a function of the path. It depends on the path up to homotopy. So if there are non-trivial homotopies, it's kind of inaccurate to say that it only depends on z. It depends on the homotopy class. Not only that, it also depends on the initial point, z0. So, but anyway, we'll get into that later. So anyway, solving the equation has to do with finding this parallel transport operator. And notice that the parallel transport operator is invertible, which means it's an element of the group. So we've gone from a Lie algebra to a Lie group. So in order to capture this, kind of simple idea of solving ODEs, what we do is define something called the fundamental groupoid. The points in the fundamental groupoid, the objects in the fundamental groupoid, are just paths up to homotopy. Here we see three of them. There's one, two, and three. These are three elements of the fundamental groupoid. It's like the fundamental group, except you don't fix a base point. You just allow any path, no matter where it ends or where it starts. And you consider them up to homotopy, which fixes the endpoints. And so I should just point out that it has a number of nice properties, this fundamental groupoid. First of all, it has a product, which means that if you have two paths, you can concatenate them as long as they line up, and you can get a third homotopy class of paths. There's also identity paths, which are just the constant paths, which sit at a certain point and don't move at all. You can always concatenate that to anything, and it won't change it. And there's also inverses of paths, meaning here I should have drawn a small arrow. You can go backwards, and that will be the inverse arrow in the groupoid. And the most important for us today is the fact that it's a manifold, because, of course, the number of degrees of freedom, like if you try to imagine this particular element in the groupoid, you could vary the initial point a little bit, and you could vary the end point a little bit. So there's really two complex degrees of freedom, or four real degrees of freedom. And clearly, this gives it a manifold structure. So this is a manifold of dimension twice whatever the original manifold X is. So this is X, here is dimension 2. The fundamental groupoid would be dimension 4. Okay. And so this fundamental groupoid is really the domain of the solutions to the system. Right? This is really where the solution matrix is defined. In other words, for every path up to homotopy, you can solve the equation, and that gives you an invertible linear map from the initial conditions on your path to your final conditions. Right? So that's why I say here that for every point in the fundamental groupoid, you get a matrix which is invertible in the group. Okay? and the product and the concatenation of two paths gives us the product of matrices. The invert path gives us the inverted matrix, and then a constant path is just the identity matrix. And this big psi, bold psi, is something that really should be called the universal solution to the system. It's really the full solution. It tells you, no matter what initial condition you give me, at no matter what point, if you go along no matter what path, I can tell you what the result is at the other side. Okay? So I just want to really emphasize this fact that the fundamental groupoid, let's say that X is a Riemann surface. Okay, so it's complex dimension one. This thing, this fundamental groupoid is complex dimension two. It's a surface. And what this means is that the solution to an ODE in one variable has a domain, which is a surface, a complex surface, which is this fundamental groupoid. That's really an important fact. Normally, we kind of ignore this fact because you don't, you know, if you know the parallel transport from one point to any other point, then you can kind of, you can figure out, if you give me some other initial point, you can always figure out what the parallel transport is. So in a sense, you have a lot of redundant data here, and that's captured by this fact, that the data is not just any map to GLNC, it's actually a multiplicative map. It's a group representation. More specifically, it's a groupoid representation. So we've taken an algebraic representation, and we've converted it now to a groupoid representation. And that's really the same thing that you do in usual courses on Lie theory, except here we're talking about ordinary differential equations. So just to kind of summarize this little story, the summary is and that there is a correspondence between representations of the tangent bundle viewed as a Lie algebraic and representations of the fundamental groupoid. And to go one way, you need to integrate the equation, and to go the other way, you need to differentiate that map. The map from the fundamental groupoid to GLNC. Okay, and so this correspondence is really the simplest case of a more general idea called the Riemann-Hilbert correspondence, which basically is the correspondence between equations and their solution data, more or less. Okay, so that's kind of step one. That's the kind of baby case of regular ordinary differential equations. Okay, so part two. So the main problem that we have now is that we want to understand a case which is not as easy because we don't have this famous theorem about existence and uniqueness. Okay, if you have an ODE, we're still considering an ODE, and if it's singular, right? So the coefficients. I don't think I can use this anymore, but I'll use this. So. If I give you an equation, I mean, one of the most famous cases is the area equation, which in the x variable looks perfectly smooth. The equation is obviously has no singularities. If you write it in the coordinate near infinity, then what you see is that you have this smooth matrix all multiplied by z to the minus 3. So it has an order 3 pole at 0 in this coordinate system. And so this is a singular differential equation coming from this order. So this is a second order singular differential equation with a pole of order 3. And whenever you have this type of thing, then this point is special. This divisor z equals to 0 is very special, and you're not allowed to parallel transport to that point. Existence and uniqueness breaks down, and you don't have that theorem about existence and uniqueness. You need to figure out some other way of kind of understanding your solutions near here. So these singular ODEs, if your ODE is singular, so if you, and I'm only considering the simplest kind of singularity, let's say a pole of order k. Okay, so if you have a singular ODE, then your solutions, so for example, here's just a linear ODE, but with a singularity of order 2, that solution is a constant times e to the minus 1 over z. This has an essential singularity at z equals to 0, right? So this is not, as we saw before, solutions should be maps from paths to GLNC. This is not a very good map to GLNC. I mean, this is obviously blowing up in a horrible way. Not only that, but if you try, I mean, one thing you could try is to try to solve this in formal power series. So this is a typical trick in your ODE class. You put in a series, get a recurrence relation for the coefficients, and then try to argue that the series has a certain radius of convergence. Typically, when you have these higher order poles, formal power series have zero radius of convergence. So you do all this work calculating all these coefficients for your series, and then you realize at the end that your radius of convergence for your so-called solution is zero, and so you don't have any solutions. Just as an example, I put this example, z to the minus 2, I put it in a diagonal matrix. So there is this equation appears here in the diagonal, but then I put an off-diagonal term. And this equation, if you try to solve it, you'll see that a solution is, well, e to the minus 1 over z like before. But then there's a second solution, which is, I wrote it as f hat with 1. And f hat, if you work it out formally, what the solution is, it turns out to be this series, n factorial z to the n plus 1. So the radius of convergence is 0. The coefficients are growing ridiculously fast. Okay. So these are all behaviors of solutions when you start getting singularities. So this fact that you do all this work to extract these coefficients and then you realize that the radius of convergence is 0, this was very frustrating to mathematicians for many years. And over a long period of time, people kind of developed techniques for taking this divergence series and trying to resum it or find, kind of extract some kind of actual solution out of it. And these procedures are sometimes incredibly complicated. They involve many unnatural steps. They're ad hoc. I don't know how else to insult them, but maybe to show you the simplest example. So the simplest example is, suppose you have a series, sum a n z n, which doesn't converge. Then what you do is that you just write zn in a different way using this integral with similar to for a gamma function. And then what you see is that you can put this in with an t to the n over n factorial. So if you did this integral, then you would just kind of cancel out this n factorial term. And so what you've done is that you've replaced the possibly divergent series with a series where each coefficient is being divided by n factorial. And then once you sum this, then you can try to integrate it. And ideally, this might have an actual meaning. Of course, the intermediate steps, it's like this series has no real invariant meaning with respect to the original formal series. It's just somehow the idea is maybe if I just divide everything by n factorial, it'll now converge. And then I can undo what I did using an integral transform. So this is called the Borel transform. And it's something that sometimes works and has many generalizations to this multisummability criteria. Okay, so our point of view, and when I say our, I really am speaking of the two collaborators that I had on the first page, which are my two students, Brent Pim and Songhao Li. So our point of view is this, that traditional solution, psi of z, just like what I just wrote before, they may have several problems. They might be multi-valued. Normally people don't worry about that because they work on the universal cover of the punctured curve, say. But anyway, they could be multi-valued. They might not be invertible in the sense that you may get a solution that actually has a zero somewhere, which is really bad if you're trying to get a representation into GLNC. But nevertheless, sometimes they have zeros. They have essential singularities. And if you work them out in power series, they might have a zero radius of convergence. And so these traditional solutions are incredibly badly behaved. And so our opinion is that the reason for all this is that they're being written on the wrong space. You're trying to write it on the curve, as a function of z. The correct place where it should be written should be a two-dimensional space, because it should be something that encodes the initial condition and the final condition. It should be something that gives you a solution matrix, a parallel transport matrix for every curve. And so it should be a two-dimensional space, something like the fundamental groupoid. But the thing is that the space that you need to use, it needs to be adapted to the type of connections that you're considering. So if your connection has a certain order pole, that should change the groupoid that you're working over. So you can't expect to use the fundamental groupoid because you know that you don't have the ODE theorem. You cannot do a parallel transport to the pole, and so you can't expect to have a representation matrix for that path. So you need something else. You need some replacement for the fundamental groupoid. And so we looked at the literature to find these groupoids because they should be very simple groupoids. They only have dimension 2. They're over a curve. And we didn't find anything in the literature which really addressed this family of groupoids, groupoids which depend on poles, a divisor on a curve. Okay, so this is the idea. The idea is really that instead of the tangent bundle, what we want to do is consider something which I call dt minus d. Oh, this is standard notation, but t minus d, these are vector, this is a vector bundle over x whose sections are vector fields which vanish on d. Okay, so if d is some point with higher multiplicity, say, then in a local coordinate near d, your vector field should be something like z to the k d by dz. And this should generate the sections. So this should be a generator for the sections. Notice the confusing thing for people who see this for the first time is that I'm saying that this is a generator. And on the other hand, you're looking at it and you see a vector field that vanishes. How could it be a generator? I'm not asking you to think of this as a vector field. I'm thinking of you to think of it as a single object, A, and just multiply it by all functions. That generates the sections of this bundle. So this is a modified, it's what's called an elementary modification of a vector bundle at a divisor. It's a slightly different vector bundle than the tangent bundle. And I'm telling you what the generators are for this sheaf of sections. Okay? And so the point is that we're going to view this connection which looks like this, d plus a of z, z to the minus k dz. So this connection, which has a pole, right? It only has a pole if you insist on trying to differentiate it using all vector fields. But if you only use vector fields which vanished at least to order k, right, then you don't see this polar behavior and the thing is perfectly smooth. So the idea is that the meromorphic connection, what it really is a representation not of the tangent bundle, but of this other bundle. Okay, so at this point it might be useful to explain what is a Lie algebroid. So these two bundles are just examples of Lie algebroids. And there are many other Lie algebroids, and they're kind of fundamental in differential geometry. So what is a Lie algebroid? It's just a vector bundle which behaves almost exactly like the tangent bundle. It's a vector bundle with a map to the tangent bundle. It has a bracket on its sections. It satisfies a Leibniz rule like this. This map which compares the algebroid to the tangent is called the anchor map. And it has basically anything you can do with the tangent bundle, you can do with this vector bundle A. For example, you could instead of doing the usual Durham complex, you can take the exterior algebra of A star, and that will have a differential because you have this bracket on A. And so when you take, in this case, if I take the exterior algebra of A star, right, this is going to be, well, depending on what dimension you're in, you're going to get things like kind of dz over z to the k. So you'll get these this type of an expression, which normally we view it as a singular one form, but now we're not viewing it as a singular one form. We're just viewing it as a dual element to this generator to t minus d. So it's just a smooth section of A star. Okay, and there are many other examples of Lie algebroids. The kind of most important one, in some sense, the simplest one, is whenever you have a foliation of a manifold, then the tangent bundle to the foliation is a vector bundle with a Lie bracket, and which behaves very much like a tangent bundle. Normally, in algebraic geometry, you call it the relative tangent bundle because it's the tangent bundle of each leaf. Okay. And then, anytime you have a Lie algebroid, you can do the same thing that you normally do for the tangent bundle. So for the tangent bundle, we normally define a connection as being a differential operator which allows you to differentiate using sections of the tangent bundle. Here you can do the same thing except using A. Okay. And so a connection for this algebraoid, the algebraoid generated by Z to the K del Z, that would look like something, just as in the usual case, it would look like the Durham differential plus a smooth matrix times a generator for the one forms, and that generator is Z to the minus K dZ. So it's exactly what we know as a meromorphic connection. Okay, so meromorphic connections are the same thing as, this is just a rephrasing, it's just language. Okay, so singular ODEs, it's the same thing as meromorphic connections, which is the same thing as representations of this algebraoid. Okay. So far it seems like just a trivial restatement of something that we already know. It's just kind of moving brackets around in some way. Okay. But the key thing is that any time that you write down a Lie algebraoid, there should be a corresponding Lie groupoid. So there's a kind of integration theory, like Lie's theorems, which take a Lie algebra and make a Lie group. Here, if I give you a Lie algebraoid, you should get a Lie groupoid. And we already saw the Lie groupoid corresponding to T. This one corresponds to the fundamental groupoid. But the question is, what does this one correspond to? It corresponds to some other type of groupoid. In general, a Lie groupoid, you should think of it as just a, imagine X is a curve and G is a surface. So this is some smooth manifold, and the points of this manifold, you should think of them as kind of generalizations of paths. They go from somewhere to somewhere else, and so what that means is that there are two maps, S and T, which map from G to X. The map S tells you where the arrow starts in X, and the map T tells you where the arrow ends in X. Okay, so every element G in G is thought of as a generalized path. And of course, there should be a composition, an associative composition on these arrows. And it should be the case that every point has a trivial path, has an identity path. And of course, everything should have an inverse. So here I gave two kind of trivial examples. One of them is the fundamental groupoid, which we already saw. And the other one is the pair groupoid, X cross X, where you don't consider homotopy classes at all. The only thing you consider are just the initial and end point. So this is the pair XY is viewed as an arrow from X to Y. In that sense, this is a very trivial groupoid. Okay, another example of a groupoid which you normally see is one that it comes from a group, right? So normally you don't even consider this a groupoid since you know you already understand Lie groups. So if you have a Lie group K that acts on a space X, then you can take the product of K with X, and that produces a manifold, each point of which can be viewed as an arrow which goes from X to the action of K on X. So this pair KX is viewed as an arrow from the initial point X to the final point K on X. And there's an obvious composition law given just by the group action. And here we see the formula for the usual action of C on C. If I let U, a complex number, act on Z by just exponentiation and multiplication, this gives us a groupoid structure on C cross C. So this is a groupoid structure on a very simple complex surface, which which gives rise to this picture. So when you look at this picture, this is a picture of the groupoid. It's almost as if I'm showing you a picture of a Lie group. Okay, so each point, this is C cross C. Each point has a source in the black line, which is X. Or here, this is just a copy of the complex plane. It's just the one-dimensional line. So each point up here is a group element or an arrow, a groupoid element or an arrow, which goes from the projection down along the vertical lines to the target, which is, if you follow this blue line, it'll intersect over here, right? So for example, this point is an arrow from here to here. And this point is an arrow from here which is where the vertical line hits the x-axis, to here, which is where the blue line hits the x-axis. So every point here represents a path in a certain way, or a generalized path going from a point in the base to another point in this base. And the actual structure is given by this formula. U times U applied to Z is e to the U times Z. Okay, so remember that that the relationship between Lie algebroids and Lie groupoids, or actually the relationship between a Lie algebra and a Lie group, is that if you have a group here with its identity element, right, then to figure out its Lie algebra, you have to differentiate. You have to take the tangent space at the identity. So the tangent space to G at the identity is the Lie algebra. Okay. In the case of groupoids, you have not one identity, but you have one identity for every single trivial path, for every point in the base. So if this is the base X, then in the groupoid, you have a whole bunch of identities, identity of X. All of these points represent trivial paths which remain fixed at a certain point. Okay, and so what this means is that you should really take in a sense, you should do this construction, but at every single point. And what that means is that you should take the normal bundle of the identity of the section of identities. So this is what I mean here. The Lie algebroid is a vector bundle over the base rather than a vector space. And the vector bundle is obtained by just taking the normal bundle of the identity bisection, as they call it, of this identity of X. And remember that we have these lines which are the fibers of the source map, right? And these lines are always transverse to this identity of X. And so you can also identify this normal bundle with the tangent to the source fibers. So if I look here, what you should see is that the Lie algebroid corresponding to this groupoid is really, you could think of it as the tangent spaces to, well, you could just think of it as the normal bundle to this line. And so that's a trivial vector bundle. Okay, but the key point is that, let me just draw this picture again to emphasize something different. So if I have the source fibers coming in like this, so these are S inverse of X. Okay. And if I take a tangent vector to this foliation, right, then I have to, this is identified with the normal bundle, so this here is just the Lie algebroid A, right? So this is an element of the Lie algebroid. This section is giving us a section of that vector bundle. But we have to remember that there's also another family of lines coming in, which are the T fibers, okay? And what this does is it allows you to project, if you project along these fibers, it projects this vector down to the base. So if we just project this way, we can take this section of the Lie algebroid and we can map it to a vector field which is parallel to the identity of X, and therefore we get a vector field on X. So the point is that there's a relationship between sections, vector fields which are tangent to the red lines, say, and the vector fields on X. So, for example, suppose that I took a trivial kind of normal direction. So suppose I took a vector field that was just normal to this identity bisection, right? Then, in order to project it, in order to kind of do the anchor map and map it to an actual tangent vector, what I would do is I would project via the blue lines. So this vector would be, so in that picture, you know, the blue lines are kind of coming in like this, right? And so if I have a vector field which is just normal like this, then the way that the projection works is that you project along the blue line. So this would be projected to a vector field pointing this way. But then there would be a zero, and the vector field would continue in that way. So what you can see is that this non-vanishing vector field tangent, which is normal to the identity bisection, is being projected in such a way that the resulting vector field has a zero. Okay. So this is the way in which the groupoid desingularizes your equation, essentially, is that downstairs it looks like your equation has a pole. In other words, the vector fields have this forced condition of being vanishing at some divisor. But above, inside this two-dimensional space, the vector field is totally non-singular. Okay, and so all I wanted to point out here is that there is this kind of general procedure, that there is a concept of Lie algebroid, and that integrates to a Lie groupoid, okay, which is very similar to the fundamental groupoid. And once you have this Lie groupoid concept, there is such a thing as a representation of a Lie groupoid. Okay, a representation of a Lie groupoid is a vector bundle on the base with an action of this, of these arrows, of these generalized arrows. For every generalized arrow, you should get an isomorphism from the fiber above the source of the arrow to the fiber over the target of the arrow. And this should be a groupoid representation. So in other words, there is nothing singular going on this groupoid. We need an invertible linear map from the source to the target of any path. It's just that we need this idea of generalized path. Okay. And what I was explaining here, we don't have to go into detail, is that any time that that you're given an A representation, a representation of the algebroid, you can always integrate it to a groupoid representation. So I just want to write this here since it is kind of an important theorem. So there's a correspondence between A representations, so representations of the algebroid, and representations of the Lie groupoid. Okay, and these are these universal solutions taking the groupoid into GLNC, perfectly smooth, or analytic, or holomorphic. And here, these are vector bundles together with connections of the appropriate type. And the point is that in order to prove this, all you need is the usual existence and uniqueness theorem for smooth ODEs. In other words, when you work at the level of the groupoid, the only thing you need to use is the usual classical theorem. There is no singular ODE when you pull it back to this groupoid. And so to prove that theorem is relatively easy. Okay, so this is the equivalence. Okay. So let me give you some examples. Okay, so this is the first, these are Stokes groupoids. So the Stokes groupoids is the simplest family of examples, and they cover any pole order going from one, up to K. So the Stokes groupoid is a groupoid over the plane. So we really have, so maybe this is a good place to put it. So we have the complex plane, which I'll draw as a line. And we have here a pole of order K. Okay. So this is D. And the groupoid up here is what we call Stoke K, the Kth Stokes groupoid. Remember that each point here represents a path in the base. And this is a two-dimensional smooth groupoid. In fact, it's just C cross C. So as a space, it's completely trivial. The source map, in this way of writing it, in these coordinates, the source map is just the projection to the first factor. The target map involves this exponential of u z to the k minus 1 times z. So for example, for k equals to 1, notice that for k equals to 1, this is just e to the u times z, which is the example that I gave you of the action of C on C. So for k equals to 1, this groupoid structure actually coincides with an action groupoid. And here it is again. So this is the picture of the groupoid for k equals to 1. So I would not consider this a really kind of good example of a groupoid because it comes from a group action. There's an actual group, C, which acts on the complex plane by the exponential map. And so this picture is a consequence of that group action. Okay? But the important thing, so something which is very important to realize, is that for k greater than 1, we also have a picture. We also have the Stokes groupoid, but this is not associated to a group action. There is no group action which generates this picture. The basic reason why I say that is that if you look at STO2, this is related to the vector field z squared d by dz. Okay? And anyone who has studied flows of vector fields would know that this thing has finite time singularity. You can't flow it. It does not generate an action of C on the base. The vector field is growing too fast and it shoots off to infinity. So there is no action involved here. And that's not even expected because this generates a Lie algebroid. The Lie algebroid generates a groupoid using just Lie's theorem, essentially. And this is the one that it generates, and it's not coming from a group action. So in a way, this is the simplest groupoid, true groupoid, and yet it doesn't occur in the literature. It's kind of strange. The literature on groupoids is funny because they don't focus on examples. They focus on the general theory. Unlike Lie groups, which focuses very much on examples, you actually classify. But there is no classification program for Lie groupoids, funnily enough. I don't know why. So for the higher order poles, I tried to draw pictures of them. This is how they look. Here you can see that this point, or this point, just to kind of remind you, is an arrow that joins this point on x to this point on x. And as the higher that you go, the kind of more extreme are the arrows kind of shooting out. Okay. There's another way of writing them, just, I don't know, to burn it into your brain. If we write it in a more symmetrical way, in other words, if we let it act symmetrically forwards and backwards in time, this would lead to a slightly nicer picture. This is the action groupoid for STO1. And then for the others, you get this. So STO2, if you notice, is not left-right symmetric. It's you need to flip as well as, so it's two reflections. Okay, but here you can clearly see this is an arrow from here to here. This is an arrow from there to there, etc. So you could imagine taking limb. And these arrows are all, you can't really see the red lines, which are also vertical, but they are arrows that join very close by points near the origin. Okay. So, so just to reiterate, this picture that you're seeing is a picture of C2 with a groupoid structure on it. The groupoid structure is a consequence of these lines that I've drawn. And the point about this is that this is the domain of definition for solutions to ODEs whenever they have an order 2 pole. That's where they are defined. In other words, what you should expect is that if you have an ODE with a second order pole, you can do whatever you want to try to solve it in the plane. So you may get multi-valued solutions, you might get singular solutions that vanish, you could get these horrible power series which don't converge. Okay, so whatever you do, do your work. If you pull it back to this space using these maps, so these are the maps which map C2 to C, so if you take your solution, your traditional solution, and you pull it back by these two maps to create a matrix upstairs, what you should expect is that thing is totally smooth and single-valued and invertible. Okay, so let me just, I just phrase that in the form of a theorem. So if you have a traditional fundamental solution, so a traditional matrix, it depends on Z, it's a matrix depending on Z. So you fixed an initial point and you fixed, you kind of fixed a branch of the logarithm or whatever. You assume that the thing has a trivial fundamental group so that it's not multi-valued. Okay, then, in other words, you've chosen a flat basis of solutions. So this may have the problems that I mentioned before, but if you
if you pull it back by the target map, and you pull it back by the source map, and you invert it, then what would this represent? This would say, you know, at a certain point in the groupoid, which has a certain source and a certain target, right? You're taking the traditional solution from whatever base point you had to that source. You're inverting it, going back to the base point, and then following the, you know, going to the target of the path. So I'm interested in the value of the matrix for a certain groupoid element, but you had a base point z0. You told me what the fundamental solution was here for the source. You told me what the fundamental solution was for the target. So in order to get the actual solution from here to here, I have to go back by the source and forward by the target. So this is the composition that you should do, and you should expect this to be smooth and invertible. And it is. It has to be. Okay. So just to show you how kind of, I mean, the following computation is only surprising to you if you've ever done a Borel summation. I mean, if you've done these integrals, you know, and if you've looked at papers of Ramis and Malgrange and all of this, and you've seen the incredible lengths they go to resum series, the following computation will be surprising to you. So take this equation that I showed you before. This is an equation with a second order pole. The solution matrix, if you remember, is this exponential to the minus 1 over z, which already is bad. But even worse than that is this formal power series f hat, which is n factorial z to the n plus 1. So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to use the source and target maps, and I'm going to pull it back by these two maps and invert the source and multiply it by the target. Okay. The only thing I need to do is I need to change coordinates z mu just because it was easy for me to do the computation in these coordinates on the groupoid. So these are not as symmetrical as the ones that I showed you before, but these are just a coordinate change on the groupoid. And so what you do is this. You just pull it back by target, pull it back by source, and invert. So if you pull it back by target, what this means is that you just put the target into this z here. So this is what I've done. The target was z over 1 minus z mu, and I just put it in here. And this is target pullback of f hat. Source pullback, the source was just z, so it doesn't really do anything to the matrix. And I've inverted this matrix by putting a plus and a minus there. And so what you get is a matrix like this. So you have e to the mu. Notice that in the coordinates on the groupoid, e to the mu is perfectly smooth. It doesn't have any zeros or poles. And then this is the surprising part. So this part here is obtained by taking a formal power series, f hat, which is zero radius of convergence. You do a change of variables where you replace z by this expression. So this is a change, you just change variables inside the formal power series. So that's a computational procedure that you can do term by term. So that's a well-defined operation on power series. This one is just pulling it back by source, which actually doesn't do anything. It just leaves the power series as a function of z. You multiply it by e to the mu. That's, again, a well-defined computation. You take the difference. So as a result of this theory, the way that it was built is that this has to be smooth. It has to converge. There's no, we don't even need to check it. It's a consequence of the whole setup, that this combination kills all of those infinite terms. And indeed, if you do this with n factorial z to the n plus 1, and you compute this, what you end up is with a sum, it's now a formal power, it's a priori a formal power series, but it's a power series in two variables because it's defined on the C cross C. And the coefficients are exactly of this form, which it's not hard to show this is convergent. This has a non-zero domain of convergence on C2. The behavior of this domain, we haven't really investigated. It's an interesting question. What is the domain of convergence, and how does it relate to the equation? But I don't know. All I know is that it has a non-zero radius of convergence in two dimensions. And this then gives you an explicit expression for this big psi. which means that no matter what your initial and final conditions are, no matter where you begin and end, I can write down a Taylor series approximation for the true solution. That's the entire point of our project, is that when you've found the correct domain of definition, any formal procedures will end up giving you the correct smooth solution. So using this point of view, the result of our first paper was really to get an explicit family of groupoids for any curve and divisor. So this could be any order of divisor. And what we tried to do was to give not just a local description, but a global description of the groupoid over the curve. And that required the use of the uniformization of the curve. So it was kind of interesting in construction from that point of view. The other thing that we get, which is this fourth thing, which is a new approach to resummation. It's giving you a new procedure that resums the series, different from the integral transform approach. And the other two things that it gives you are works in progress. One of them is to study this isomonodromy flat connection, the process of isomonodromy in integrable systems. It seems to be illuminated a little bit by this point of view. And the other thing that we're looking at is if you want to extract the Stokes matrices from this groupoid, there seems to be a way of doing that. Of course, it has to be possible because the groupoid representation captures the full solution. So just to conclude, there's an interesting quote of Abel, which was originally in French and which has inspired many mathematicians to work on the subject of divergent series. And he says, divergent series are, and you have to imagine this in French, it's even more plaintive in that language. Divergent series are in general something terrible, and it is a shame to base any proof on them. We can prove anything by using them, and they have caused so much misery and created so many paradoxes. We hardly find in mathematics any infinite series whose sum may be determined in a rigorous fashion, which means the most essential part of mathematics has no foundation. For the most part, it is true that the results are correct, which is very strange. I am working to find out why, a very interesting problem. So what I would like you to do, is, you know, given the audience, is maybe to replace this word with physics. And we have all of these perturbation theory expansions. And I didn't really know this when I was taught the subject, this subject of renormalization. I didn't know that Dyson spent 4 years of his life trying to prove that the perturbation series for QED converged. He tried to prove that it converged, right? And then it was after 4 years that he published a 3-page paper proving that it couldn't possibly converge. And so the typical answer nowadays is that it's an asymptotic series. It's an asymptotic approximation, right? To what? Of course, this is a problem you all know very well, but I don't know. It's been 200 years since this statement. It's kind of worrying. I'll end with that. Thank you for your attention.
So we like to start by giving students the chance to ask the first questions. So are there any students that have questions?
I guess they need a microphone.
I'm trying to wrap my head around this groupoid. Can you hear me?
Now I can, yeah.
Okay, I'm trying to wrap my head around these groupoids and Lie algebraoids. And you seem to say that there's a one-to-one correspondence between their representations.
Yeah.
Because for Lie groups and Lie algebras, the topology of Lie group usually plays a role, right?
That's true, yeah, exactly. That's a good point.
Do you have certain subtleties here?
Yeah, there's a little subtlety, which is exactly the same subtlety as in for Lie groups. There's no difference. Actually, when you go from a Lie algebraoid to a Lie groupoid, there's a lattice, or there's a partially ordered set of them, depending on the fundamental group. So it's exactly the same. So what the people say is,
is that what should be here actually is the source simply connected groupoid. In other words, it's the unique groupoid whose source fibers are simply connected. And actually the target fibers are therefore simply connected. So this thing about the fundamental group of this integration is exactly the same thing. It's exactly the same idea. So this Stokes groupoid that I presented, if you remember, the fibers are what? They're just C. They're just the complex line. So they're simply connected. So then you don't have to worry about it in that case.
More student questions? Okay, well, maybe we'll open to questions from everybody.
Should bring it. Someone has a question down here.
Ah, okay, thanks.
Yeah, the question is, your theorem says that something is smooth and single valued, which means probably that this pullback is defined on the whole surface. Yeah, but you made like birational transformation, so which means that you replace your surface by just by birational equivalence, so it can in general destroy smoothness.
If you do a birational transformation to the
but
surface.
But you did, not I. Yeah, but.
Well, so this thing about birational, so the fundamental groupoid is, let's say, Stokes zero. There is no pole. That's the fundamental groupoid. It's just C cross C with the two projections. And if you want to get the higher Stokes groupoid, one way of doing it is by doing a sequence of blow-ups and then removals. So you blow up and you remove some loci, you blow up again, you remove some other loci, and you get the Stokes groupoid. So to produce this groupoid, it was a sequence of, one way of thinking about it is that it's birationally related to the fundamental groupoid. And the point is that if you did this pullback of your fundamental solution, if you pulled it back to the fundamental groupoid, the simple one, it would be singular. But if you keep blowing it up in the proper way, in the correct way, then eventually it becomes smooth. But keep in mind that it's not just a blow-up, it's also a removal. There are certain things that are not part of the groupoid that you must remove, which are somehow part of the compactification of the group. So these groupoids have, in some way, natural compactifications, which are important for the Stokes phenomenon. But for the universal solution, it's defined on the, you know, if you want to know which thing in the birational class is it defined on, it's defined on Stoke K, where K is the correct order of the pole. That's the one that selects which one it's defined on.
If you have a divisor, so if you have just many points, you do blow ups for each.
That's right, yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
More questions?
I mean, you worked it out on algebraic curves. Can you also do something similar on higher dimensions?
Yeah, of course, the way that we. So the main content of our paper has to do with constructing the groupoid. And there were several methods that we used for different cases. Some of them are birational constructions, which you can do in any dimension. One of them that's the one, maybe the biggest one, the one that is the source simply connected groupoid for a curve with arbitrary divisor. We use the uniformization of the complement of the divisor as a tool to build the thing. And that's one obstruction in higher dimension. I have no idea how to work with the uniformization of complements of divisors of, let's say, surfaces. If you take out a divisor, then the uniformization, how do you build the uniformization? How do you specify it in some way, except to say that it's, you know, it's not enough to just say take the universal cover. We needed some construction that produces it so that we could extend it to produce the full groupoid, and that's the problem. That's the only reason why one is different from two from our point of view.
Hi there, yeah, I had two questions. First of all, can I trust Borel resummation? So if I've got some divergent series and it is Borel resummable, your new methods will give back the same answer as the original Borel transform, provided that works.
I missed a little bit. So yes. Can you trust what part?
So if I've got a divergent series that is Borel resummable,
yes.
your new method will give back the same result as that Borel re-summation. So I can't,
Borel. At any given point, I mean, it's just, in a region where the solution actually makes sense on the base, then there's only, you know, up to GLN, it's unique, the solution. So it will produce a solution. There is a good question about, you know, how do you select, if you're at a given point and you want a certain type of asymptotics, if you want to fix the asymptotics beforehand, and you want to get that particular solution, that's a different question. But if you want to just construct a solution, if you want to solve the equation, that's what this makes particularly clear.
And then I guess I was just wondering if you could perhaps expand about more, like the problems we're interested in, say, in statistical physics, you're computing a critical exponent. We know the first few terms in some divergent perturbation series.
Yeah.
And we've got an idea of what the large order behavior of this series is from instanton type calculations.
Yes, yes.
And you know what we really do in practice is we take those first couple of terms, we do a Borel Padé approximation to fill in what the higher terms in that series might be, and then we would try and Borel resum. But I mean, in a sense, could your methods give a better solution?
Well, I mean, my point of view on those types of approaches is similar to, I mean, you know, in quantum field theory, that's what you do all the time, and as far as I understand, the reason for that is that you don't have an understanding of the infinitesimal situation. In other words, here the thing that I used was that I knew which Lie algebroid it was that I was looking at the representations of. In other words, I knew what the pole structure was beforehand, and I knew that it was a linear system or something. Mm. So in your case, you have like maybe Dyson-Schwinger equations which govern the behavior of the physical observable, but those are not really differential equations. So it's somehow the infinitesimal picture is not clear enough. But if it was made clear enough, then the problem of integration should be secondary. So I don't know if that helps.
Any more questions? Well, if not, let's thank Marco again.
Thanks.